project will be
Yeah.
published
Yeah.
as a NASA special monograph.
Yeah.
And we're working on a contract with University of Alabama in Huntsville.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if you would, maybe we could begin and you could just summarize briefly your personal experience in the Saturn program. And then maybe we can talk a little bit more about your role in the manufacturing end of it and some of the contractual developments that occurred and some of the relationship with contractors.
Oh, actually, I was very much involved at the beginning of the Saturn I, even at the first clustered test item. You know, it was the year, I cannot remember, it was 67, no, 57 or 58,
mm-hmm.
where we got the first 10, 12 million about for a demonstration of a clustered engine fire.
Mm-hmm.
And there we had to take half of the money and get some engines. We were aware that the S3D engine we had at the time, which was used for the Jupiter, it's just unsuitable for clustering.
Could you explain why?
Why? Simply it had a special thrust frame. The thrust frame had three legs,
mm-hmm.
times eight, 24 hard points of the engine to the vehicle,
mm-hmm.
plus all the suction lines and so on. It would be a really a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
So what we first tried to do, get the engine in a shape that it's easier to cluster them. And actually, we succeeded by having only one attached point of the engine to the thrust frame or to the vehicle itself.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we had additional for four engine, the actuator hard points. In the other case, the actuator hard points would have been within the thrust frame.
Mm-hmm.
But the total problem was somehow simplified by having the engine repackaged. And we were able to do the repackaging job of the engine because some work was already done in advance. We had a program running with Rocketdyne which looked at a simplification or a reduction of the components to an engine. And they came out with a simplified engine.
Mm-hmm. Is that the REAP program? Is that what I'm thinking of?
Which one?
REAP?
No.
Or was that a different program?
No.
Okay.
I don't know about. Yeah. I'm not aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by all, it was that was a S3DX or something like that engine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was just a experimental effort by Rocketdyne,
mm-hmm.
to reduce the components. They were successful, of course. And we spent about half of our $12 million to order some engines.
Mm-hmm.
And Rocketdyne, and we had to practically steal out of all kind of programs, including out of retired hardware, portion of acceptable and usable hardware, to manufacture the eight H1 engines,
mm-hmm.
which were designated H1,
mm-hmm.
and. The residual, the other $6 million which remained, supposed to have served us for the vehicle, that means for the container and for the test and modification. We had a really hard time, you know, to get along with half the money to establish tanks. And at that time, we of course looked in all possible solutions to save money,
mm-hmm.
and the only way to save money was to use tooling we had, and with that tooling we had, we were able to fabricate the 105 inch and what was the other? What's the redstone diameter?
70
inch diameter,
yeah.
tanks,
mm-hmm.
and with those available tooling, we saved again money and produced some tankage which was able to enabled us to demonstrate the firing on the test end.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, nobody talked about a vehicle. The first approach was just to have a demonstration of a clustered engine. But we were just in the process of going into the design of the testing, design of the test equipment. Then the request came, now you make it fly. Yeah? So there was no way around. We just had to take with what we started, you know, these multiple tanks. Yeah? And now there came another request. Of course, that big vehicle cannot be launched from the United States. We are looking for an equatorial launch site, and we skirted across the Pacific, you know, to look for an equatorial launch site. And for that purpose, the total first stage has not only to be to fly, but had to be broken down in pieces to be air transportable with the transporter we had at that time. So we designed the first stage to be like a Tinker toy, you know, to take it apart, to be air transportable, and to stick it together on the launch site.
And an equatorial launch site.
At the equatorial launch site, that was the first approach.
Was and that included in the spider frame and so on.
Right. Yeah. That's you know, the point is, the thrust frame was one major item, and we had to design it so that the arms of the thrust frame could be taken out.
I was going to ask you how you were going. Yeah. How you?
Yeah. That's if you look at the first design, it's really you can break it down to. Items not to exceed 105 inches to be transportable in an airplane.
Was there any thought at that time, too, of using the Saturn I in an Earth orbital rendezvous?
Oh, that comes much later.
Okay.
That was later. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm talking just about the first phases of the S-1B.
Mm-hmm.
And,
for the S-1.
S-1, Saturn I. And there was a stage in between where we tried even to get eventually the so-called E1 engine. That was a 380-pound RP LUX engine, which had, which was not even experimental. It was in a design phase with Orkadyne, but they wanted so much money we couldn't even afford it. So, the solution with the repackaging of the S3D engine to an H1 engine was really the solution we could accept at that time.
So if
that goes farther, you know.
But the S1, you really didn't design the thing as a flyable vehicle. If you were going to have done that, it would have been a different
design.
That's
the point. Oh, naturally, you know, if we would have optimized it, if we would have had enough money to optimize it,
mm-hmm.
we could have built a much lighter, more efficient stage. As we have today,
mm-hmm.
the multicellular tanks. Theoretically, the weight of the all the cylindrical walls is not bigger as if you would build a single tank,
mm-hmm.
but the weight of the multiple bulkheads
and the lines and
so on, they add.
Mm-hmm.
So we were definitely off optimum.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you just. Made it a virtue and said, this is a solution, you know.
Yeah.
It was so ingrained in some people's mind that they even offered us the S4 hydrogen stage
mm-hmm.
as multicellular tank in some solution. Some people, some companies offered it.
Because they thought Marshall would like it.
Yeah, Marshall likes the multiple tanks, you know.
Yeah.
But it was not the point. Yeah. We didn't like the multiple tank. We just had to go it because we didn't have enough money to start the project efficiently.
And when you went from the S3D to the H1, then there really wasn't much of a to reason go out and advertise for a new engine. You were still trying to work with what
right.
you had and
right.
fit it to the
right.
actually the Jupiter and Redstone tankage you were using.
We were using Redstone Jupiter tankage, the S3D engine, which had a thrust frame. Which was the dimensions were even fitting the Redstone vehicle, the Thor, for instance, had to use that same thrust frame we laid out with Rocketdyne some times ago for a Redstone vehicle, because we thought we would have a chance to operate the Redstone by using RP locks. And at that time, as they started the S3D, you know, we gave them just, they were asking, what kind of thrust frame would you prefer? And we told them, okay, build it for the Redstone, you know. So the 65 inches thrust frame connecting bolt on a diameter of 65 inches, they fit the Redstone. You know? That's how it goes. You know? So, but that engine never was used on the Redstone. The Redstone was on the A1, A4 engine. A1, A4, I think.
Why was there so much doubt about the validity of the clustered concept? They thought that there would be too much variation in thrust, that it would skew the vehicle around?
There were several doubts. First, the dynamic behavior of those long tanks. They could probably be excited in certain modes, like reeds, you know, by the aerodynamic forces.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, for the first firing, we had quite some investigation, quite some discussion on the dynamic behavior of the multiple tanks.
Mm-hmm. This is 201 then.
Yeah. That was 201.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not even 201. No, that was before. Oh, was okay.
Yeah. 201. Yeah.
First 7-1 firing.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Were there any other doubts outside of this problem of vibration and so on?
No, the vibration and, of course, the propellant utilization,
mm-hmm.
the residual question was still in our mind, because the emptying of the tanks determines the efficiency of the stage.
And how did you manage that? Did you have to come up with some different electronic gear to get those residuals down even there?
No, we made quite some effort in flow models to find out how that behaves.
Mm-hmm. And you had no trouble either with running all these lines underneath
there?
No,
it was a nice design job, you know, to get the interconnect lines properly into the skirts and the connecting lines to the engines. Then we had the wraparound lines around the engines, which allow the swiveling.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite, despite the fact that we had a nice diameter of 200 many inches, yeah. It was quite crowded.
Well, that turned out to be a pretty successful vehicle.
It was a successful vehicle, I agree.
Would you be willing to go that mode again if you really had a...
No, the only thing, if I had these engines, I wouldn't use multiple cellular tanks. I would use single tanks. I think it would be a much more efficient stage.
Mm-hmm. How about when Chrysler tanks. Came in to start working on these things? Were there difficulties in getting Chrysler people geared up
Not at all. You know, we had a very good report with Chrysler, because they were working on the Jupiter, they were working on the Redstone, and both programs were actually still going as Chrysler shifted over to the actual 71B work.
So there's a very good backlog of personnel.
A very good backlog of nicely trained people which really understood the problems, and that was a transition which worked as proven very, very successful. We designed the first vehicle in-house and transferred afterwards the design to Chrysler.
Mm-hmm.
But we had already on that in-house design Chrysler people in training, so that this, the transition was even easier.
Mm-hmm. As I recall, a sequence of the Saturn I vehicles, of which there were 10, we got up to AS207, which the flight rated it. It was qualified at that point. It was a very successful flight. And then the last three were Pegasus flights.
Oh, but you know, yeah,
But instead of going 208, 209, 2010, we did 209 and then 208, which was the first Chrysler vehicle.
Yeah.
Was Chrysler slow at one point, or did you have some difficulties in there?
It was the buildup of the Michoud facility.
Okay.
Which went slower as expected.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to pull 9 ahead and have 8 fired later.
And you were still building the rest of them up here then, at Marshall?
At that time, we were building them still here.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What major things, besides upgrading the engines, did you do in terms of structures when you went into the S-1B?
Oh, we of course cleaned up. Oh, there was another point. In the middle of the work on the Saturn I, that time the Air Force did not have any vehicle for the dinosaur firing. And we obtained the order to preserve the capability to fire the dinosaur with the Saturn I. And that required that we put fins on, which were all barn doors, you know? Remember those big fins?
Mm-hmm.
And we had all the designs finished, and they were in the shop, practically. There came the order again, forget about the dinosaur, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we were still on the same schedule before. And whatever, the only thing we could do is practically chop off the fins, you know. You can imagine that the loads of these overhanging fins, you know, over-designed now the short fins, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the vehicle was absolutely off optimum all the way, you know. You just couldn't help it because the schedule was there. You had to remain on schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as we redesigned it to the Saturn 1B, yeah, there we optimized the thrust frame, took those, you know, this detachable outriggers off, designed a proper thrust frame, and took the large fins off, designed smaller fins, and regained almost 10,000, over 10,000, 12,000 pound of payload by those redesigns.
Mm-hmm. You were involved too then with the S-1C?
At that time we were not yet, we started very soon afterwards with the S-1C.
Mm-hmm.
I was at that time director of the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
You're aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was director responsible in the S-1, not only for the design, I also had the monetary management of the project.
Mm-hmm.
From the beginning on in the structural mechanics laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
Later we were already deeply in to design and actually procurement, and I don't know, we had already started with interfacing with other upper stages and so on, where the whole activity of the management was transferred to the Saturn office, which was newly created.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning, the total project responsibility was in S&M, in structural mechanics laboratory.
Could I ask you a question about interfacing with using the S-1, for example, when you got into finally working with Douglas to get the S-4 on and everything?
Yeah, yeah.
What kind of difficulties or problems there did you have with the interfacing, or were there none at all? How did you?
No, wait a minute. That didn't go so fast before we got to the Douglas contract. You know, first we were stated to use whatever upper stage is available, whatever stage is available. That means, you know, we had to design the upper interface so that we are ready to take whatever is forthcoming. We had to look into the Atlas. Oh, I'm taking this as...
No, that's...
You have not.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. And we had to look at the Titan as upper stages.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time we decided, okay, the Titan might be one usable upper stage, which is 120 inches. Yeah? So we had a monstrosity, you know, 220, 120.
Yeah.
But that's not the whole story. In the meantime, we also, of course, you know, the stages are pretty expensive. Somebody got the idea, you better recover the stage. So we had in the first three stages the design to design into the stage a recovery possibility. So we had actually, if you look at the design of those old stages, we had designed into it a container for a parachute. We had started the parachute development. It was on and off, and finally we decided there was no money. We had to take it out. Mm-hmm. So at that time already, we were seriously thinking of recovering the stages. Whether it would have been actually economical, we don't know. But we started parallel studies of dunking engines in seawater, leaving them in seawater, uh-huh. taking them out, and just drying them out, mm-hmm. and firing them, and or inspect them first and firing them. We succeeded in a way. But, you know, it's not only the engine. There's a lot of electronic equipment and so on. Actually, if you would have recovered the stage, you would have broken it down into components, inspect all the components, and assemble them again. And the manpower used, you would use twice the amount of manpower taking it apart and assembling it.
Easy to build a stage.
Was easier to, probably more economic to build a new stage, mm-hmm. because so and so many... percentage of the component would have been anyway rejected as not usable because it started to corrode. Mm-hmm. As soon as you take it out of the salt water, you know, you start
corrosion. You get a problem, yeah.
That's no other way around. So we also had, at that time, this parachute container again to design out as soon as we started to get into the S4 preposition. Mm-hmm. And Douglas at that time was chosen on based on competitive bidding. They came out with a very intriguing new preposition on an upper stage.
Well, how was it intriguing or new?
Was the first use of several. That's another story again. You know, I mean, that is so complicated. Mm-hmm. There was one of those famous reviews with the director of Lewis.
Silverstein.
Yeah, there was one committee after the other, and they
really?
Were really quizzing us. I know exactly. I had to justify the redesign of that monstrosity, which was designed to be taken apart and to fly the dinosaur. And I had to justify why I intend to redesign the whole tail, because it was much too heavy. And building it on entirely different under entirely different ground rules. Now, there was one committee. The people were talking about the upper stages. And obviously, neither the Atlas nor the Titan was in any way, performance-wise and diameter-wise, suitable. Mm-hmm. So at that time, it was somewhere in December, they had a meeting, and von Braun was up there, and he called me up and told me, we are very seriously considering to use oxygen. As preparing for the upper stage. One engine is being tested now, he said, and there will be about 30 Centaur flights, mm-hmm. ahead of a S4 flight before you fly it. Do you think that you will be able to handle that? And I said, of course, you know, 30 flights, well, we will have a lot of background, and if it flies, we can do it too. Yeah. So we built the stage, and we flew the S4 stage ahead of a successful Centaur firing. Yeah. Uh-huh. They fired one firing ahead of us, but it was not
a failure.
Was a failure. And mm-hmm. we had the first successful S4 firing, and we fired more engines on the S-4.
With six instead of two.
In the Hutoru program, we were faster firing the engines, the R-10 engines on the S-4 than they were firing on the Centaur.
That's a very intriguing story. Now, can you give some insights as to how you were able to do that so well and so quickly?
That was a very, very ticklish technological problem, because it was the first time that such a large stage was built.
Oh, it's much larger than Centaur, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And there were many new technologies. If you look at the stage, number one, it was hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
We use oxygen. Hydrogen has obviously some special properties. And then we had first time the internal insulation, which is a problem in itself.
Mm-hmm.
We had the first time a common bulkhead. We were brave enough to say, okay, it makes no difference whether common or uncommon, it has to be tight anyway. Otherwise, with hydrogen, you have trouble, you know, because the combustion range, you know, and the explosive range is from 4% to 96% mixture ratio.
Mm-hmm.
So wherever you are, you know, you explode. You know?
Okay.
So you have to be tight. And therefore, we were brave enough to say, if we have tight, we have to be darn sure, so we can also go to a common bulkhead.
Mm-hmm.
And we accepted the specific design of Douglas, which separated the oxygen and the hydrogen by a common bulkhead. It's actually a double bulkhead. And we insisted, but at that time, that the space in between be checked and tested or under control.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to have a sniffer on the insulation of the between the two bulkheads.
Was that largely a Douglas innovation, that particular style of common bulkhead?
The common bulkhead, it was brought up by them.
Yeah.
It was always somewhere in the drawings. You know, whenever you design the guided missiles, you know, you find very fast that you pay a lot of lengths,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. By having double bulkheads.
Mm-hmm.
And the obvious solution is to have a single bulkhead, as we had it in the, for instance, we had it in the Jupiter. Mm-hmm. We had a single bulkhead in the Jupiter. But we had LOX and RP. And that was a single phased bulkhead. And the oxygen level went high enough not to touch the upper bulkhead.
Mm-hmm.
So we gained somehow on length already with that approach. The Jupiter was pretty stubby, a pretty stubby vehicle.
Mm-hmm. I remember some configurations,
yeah.
In general.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, and the next step, of course, would have been something similar, but the temperature difference from LOX to hydrogen,
mm-hmm.
requires insulation.
Well, you know, Douglas apparently came up with a better design than Convair had done in the Centaur, too.
Yeah.
I think they used the phenolic honeycomb or something inside there, too.
No, that's also phenolic honeycomb.
Yeah.
That's also.
Yeah.
Honeycomb.